Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering the 2025 Homegrown Music Festival in Kingston.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
It was announced on Wednesday that Homegrown Live Music Festival, the annual all-local music festival that took over downtown Kingston on Saturday, May 3rd, achieved record turnout, with over 1,800 attendees, approximately 300 more than the previous record. Homegrown is in support of Joe's Musical Instrument Lending Library, a nonprofit established in honor of Joe Chitlin, a young, beloved musician in Kingston who passed unexpectedly on May 1, 1999. Joe's Mill has 1,300 instruments available for borrowing, fulfilling Joe's vision of giving everyone a chance to learn to play an instrument. The city was fully immersed in the one-day festival with over 145 acts on 17 stages at venues across the city, including more than 400 individual local musicians who donated their time and talents to support the library. Chris Morris, one of the festival organizers, spoke with CFRC about the energy on the day.
You know, to see 400 plus musicians coming out in one day to all volunteer their time, I think that's the kind of energy that hypes up the rest of the community. Like, so many people, and we're lucky that we have these numbers that we can really brag about. So many people are just excited. Oh my god, there was so much music happening, all, and it's all in one day. People always ask about, like, you know, let's do another one in the fall, or let's make it a whole weekend. But I don't have any more energy in the year than to do it just once. But we keep it all compressed in one day, so there's just this energy and this vibe of there is music everywhere, and you hear it pouring out of the Caesar Company, and you hear it coming out of the Toucan basement, and, you know, we've got two bands playing at the same time at the Buckle and at the Mansion and all this stuff. So it's just like, and you see people walking around with guitar cases and amplifiers and drum kits, and it's, you see them crossing Market Square, what, you know, passing each other, saying, oh, hey, I'm going to play there now. Oh, you're going to play the Toucan. Great. It's that kind of thing. You know, there's just like 400 plus musicians. They're all downtown at the same time for the same cause. And I think that's what the energy is. And the music fans, which, you know, those are the ones that ultimately buy the wristbands and give us the money to make the donation. They're, they love that. Oh my God, I'm going to plot out my whole day. You know, I'm going to go downtown from 1 o'clock until 9 o'clock, and I'm going to see these seven bands. And you see them at a bar stool with a Sharpie highlighting where they're going to go, making sure they have a map or whatever.
Homegrown is the Mill's largest fundraiser of the year. And this year, the community came through with a grand total of $15,400 in donations. Denis LaRue, president of Joe's Mill, spoke about how the donations will support the mill and, by extension, the community in an interview with CFRC.
We depend on donations and events like this for us to continue to operate. So $15,000 is about 10% of our budget, which is fantastic. So what we do is we'll use that money towards more instruments, towards our education program. We now go out into schools and provide musical workshops to students. Joe's mantra was always, wouldn't it be great if everybody had the opportunity to play an instrument? And here we are 25 years later, and we are giving that opportunity to everybody, from young kids to old fogies like me who just want to go out and borrow an instrument for $25 a year, and that's just for the library card. you can go out and rent any of the 1,300 instruments that we have. Yes, I did say 1,300 instruments, from sitars to xylophones to drums to stuff like guitars. But we have so many different instruments there. What we hope is that people borrow those instruments and become lifelong players.
Aside from the changing landscape of venues and the new addition of a comedy stage this year, Homegrown has maintained a steady approach since its inception. Chris and Denis reflected on why this year was such a hit.
We haven't really changed Homegrown that much. Like, we've been doing it almost the exact same way for 17 years. So we just, you know, we try to expand. We have to adapt to the changing landscape, particularly in, with respect to venues. The musicians are really excited to play. I think that's probably the ultimate factor. I mean, we could do logistics all day long, but if no one wants to see these acts, and if the acts don't help promote the festival, then people aren't going to get that excited, right? So I think I saw a lot of social media posts from bands that were just treating this as a big gig, which is great. Sometimes it's a little surprising because they're playing for free and, you know, it's kind of short set sometimes. So, you know, it's like, oh my God, we are playing Homegrown live. You must come see us, which is what we want to see. And it's great to see bands that are excited and taking ownership, pride in playing Homegrown and supporting the cause.
People have always loved Homegrown. And I think what happened when COVID hit, we saw a downturn, of course, and it took a few years for Homegrown to get back to what it was before. And I think what's happened now is that people are in the swing of things. Even though it was raining, we got a lot of people out. And I think people just love the fact that you, for $10, you can go and see over 140 artists playing in 15 or so venues. And also that it's for the support of Joe's Mill. Whenever I speak and I talk about Joe's Mill, I get loud applause. I think people think and know what a cool place it is and how cool it is to have a musical instrument library. You just don't see that anywhere else.
Both Chris and Denis also highlighted the increase in youth participation that made this year special.
You know, one thing I was thinking about, because, you know, Homegrown always comes around the anniversary of when Joe Chitlin passed away. Every few years, we actually have Homegrown on the anniversary, but he died May 1st, where I was the first weekend in May, right? So so I was thinking, as I was sort of putting out my annual sort of post about Joe, is that it's been 26 years. And, you know, people my age and older got to see him play and knew him a little bit. But there were so many people that played Homegrown that were like born after Joe passed away, or were far too young to go see him at Toucan, right? So so that was kind of on my mind a lot this year. And I was really amazed at how many people come out to play for this thing that is his legacy, that is this memorial tribute to him, right? So and people, you know, saying, oh man, like, I wish I would have known him, or it sounds like he was the coolest guy, and he was. so that part of Homegrown, you know, to me this year in particular, was really touching.
Youngsters playing, and the vibe down there was just wonderful, hearing these kids playing music and performing sometimes for the first time was just really cool.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the planned revitalization of the Seeley's Bay Hall.
Thank you, Jesse. The Seeley's Bay Hall is not closing. In fact, it's getting a much-needed upgrade. At its recent meeting in Lansdowne, Township of Leeds and Thousand Islands Council approved the award of a tender for the replacement and retrofit of the aging HVAC system at the Seeley's Bay Hall. The contract was awarded to Ubcon Construction Limited in the amount of $98,222, inclusive of net HST. Originally identified for replacement in 2023 and budgeted as part of the 2024 capital plan. The HVAC system has become increasingly unreliable, with operational costs climbing year after year. A previous tender issued in 2024 received no bids, prompting staff to adjust the scope of the project. The redesign reflects anticipated changes to the building's use, with the fire department vacating the premises. The upgrade will include a new 15-ton carrier rooftop unit that will connect to the existing ductwork. The propane-fired furnace is intended to reduce electrical load during emergency situations. Supporting work includes installation of a new cement pad, privacy fencing, and interior lobby vestibule alterations. The project will be funded from the township's 2025 capital budget, which allocated $128,300 for the HVAC and lighting upgrades. With the HVAC work coming in well under budget, funds remained available for lighting improvements at the hall. This investment reinforces the township's commitment to the long-term future of Seeley's Bay Hall as a vital community space. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LGI reporter for the Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forstell, about the heroic actions of a local UPS driver.
A local UPS driver is being lauded as a hero for saving a senior citizen from a burning home. Lee Spafford was driving his UPS delivery truck on Wednesday, May 14th, when he noticed a burning house on Dolcher Street in Kingston. According to witnesses, he heroically ran into the burning building and rescued a woman with mobility issues, likely saving her life. Kingston City Councilor Jimmy Hassan served as the primary witness for the daring rescue. Hassan recalled standing with a crowd at a barrier near the Dolcher Street fire. He asked the crowd what was happening and was told there was a fire in one of the houses and that a 90-year-old woman with a disability had been trapped inside. She used a walker and had not been able to move quickly. Quote, apparently she didn't even realize her house was on fire, Hassan said. UPS driver Lee Spafford had been delivering a package nearby and dashed into her house. The two emerged a short time later and the woman was handed over to emergency services for medical treatment. A spokesperson for the City of Kingston confirmed that Kingston Fire and Rescue responded to a structure fire on the 400 block of Dolcher Street at approximately 2:40 p.m. on May 14th. While they were en route to the call, heavy smoke was visible in the area. Upon arrival, firefighters encountered heavy smoke and flames coming from the rear and roof of the residence. Crews acted quickly to apply water to the exterior of the home and then moved inside to continue fire suppression and search efforts. Once the fire was fully extinguished, the fire prevention team with Kingston Fire and Rescue was called in to investigate, and they determined that the cause of the fire was improper disposal of smokers' materials. No injuries were reported, and the cost of the damages is estimated at $100,000.
Thank you, Jesse. Now over to the LJA reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the results of Loyalist Township's ward boundary vote.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
It was a close 4-3 vote in favor of a proposed ward boundary update at Loyalist Township's council meeting this week. The three opposing members voiced concerns about fair representation and extreme population disparity. At a special committee of the whole meeting last month, it was a 4-3 vote as well. After much discussion, option one was chosen and brought to council. This option will see the division of the existing three wards into five new wards. The new configuration includes Amherst Island as its own ward, although its population is only around 450 people. Councillor Jake Ennis made note of this while speaking about population disparity.
It's well established that a variance of up to 25% can be appropriate for good reason, perhaps up to 33% in some municipal OLT decisions. Here it's 500% plus. If this bylaw stands, I think it would set a problematic precedent. If 919 people in one ward versus over 5,000 people in other wards is okay, when does the disparity ever become not okay?
Ennis spoke about different views towards each option.
In my view, those supportive of this motion are okay with mixing rural mainlanders and urban mainlanders in one ward, but are not okay with mixing islanders and mainlanders in one ward. Why? I'm not sure. My view is that those supportive of this option erred in their focus on this community versus that community, where instead the main focus, in my view, should have been on each person in Loyalist and each person's charter right to relative equality of voting power and effective representation.
More information and an interactive map are available on the township's website. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about the 150th birthday for a Port Hope church.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. The Port Hope United Church is turning 150 years old. A celebration is being planned for June to commemorate the structure's history, but also the evolution of the church in the community. Over the decades, the church has maintained its historic feel, but also embraced a progressive attitude to reflect the needs of its congregation. I spoke with the Reverend Kevin Moore at his church inside the historic sanctuary.
It was completed in 1875 and opened in the spring of that year. It was Port Hope Methodist Church at that point in time, and 50 years later became Port Hope United Church in 1925 when the United Church was formed, which was a coming together of Methodist, Presbyterian, and Congregational churches to form the United Church of Canada.
Now, as we stand in this sanctuary, this room, you kind of get the feel of the age of this room.
Yeah.
Speak to how you're able to maintain that and keep this atmosphere the way it is.
Well, this space is of great importance to us as a congregation and to the community, so there have been some alterations over the years and some modernizations, but by and large, we have worked incredibly hard to keep the feel and the look of the sanctuary that was built 150 years ago. In particular, the stained glass, the pews, the balcony, all of these things go back to the original building. And it's taken a lot of work over the years for this congregation to maintain it and for upkeep, but it's used as a concert facility. We feel like it is our worship space, but it's also a community space that is very significant, and we pride ourselves on maintaining this.
So over the last 100 years, how have you seen this church evolve and grow in this community?
Well, in the early days of this church, which go back to the early 1800s, it was Methodist circuit riders that came to town they had a circuit of four or five stops that they would go to. And they did eventually, or after a few years, build a church across the road, basically still at South and Brown. It was a wood frame church. But that early congregation started to outgrow that building, and so they began construction of this church. Actually, in 1874, the other church burnt down, the wood frame, and so they had to meet in a local meeting hall for about a year. The grand opening here in 1875, I've read that there were 1,500 people that came to that first opening. I don't know where they put them all, because I've been told about 800 is the max you can get in here. So maybe they exaggerated a little, but maybe not. Maybe they were hanging off the rafters. And the early church in those days was quite large. Big congregation, big Sunday school, big programs. So to have hundreds here on a Sunday was not unusual. With the United Church forming in 1925, and this church becoming a United Church, then change and evolution started to happen. The United Church has always been a fairly progressive church. Over the years, we were the first church in the world to recognize same-sex ministers. We have done first church in Canada to issue an apology to First Nations people for our part in the residential schools and other things that have happened. we continue to be progressive and outward-looking. And this church has had its ups and downs over all of those years. Certainly at this point in time, we are a growing church and new people are coming, and we are actively connected in the community. And so we are trying very much to maintain the best of the traditions of this place, but not get locked into them, and really try to be relevant and bring something to the faith community and to the larger community that is meaningful in 2025. So, yeah, exciting days behind us for sure, but we really believe there are some exciting days ahead.
For sure, for sure. As we stand here, we're looking at your organ, your pipe organ here. Mm-hmm. Is that the original location of the pipe organ?
More or less, it's not the original pipe organ, but this one certainly goes back many, many years. Some new pipes. These pipes were there, I think, as part of the original. And the choir was actually up above here, and then they dropped them down at some point. So there have been some modifications over the year. And I can't remember the exact year when this organ was, I want to say back in the 1950s, perhaps, that this organ was put in place. But no, much of what you see has been here since the place opened. So, and it's a beautiful organ. It's played every Sunday and played at other times throughout the year for sure.
So kind of looking at the future, mm-hmm. and I know that the United Church has always been very progressive,
yeah.
as you said earlier about residential schools. How do you see the church continuing to evolve and meet not only the religious aspect of the church, but the community need?
Yeah, social justice has always been front and center for United Churches. I think we are trying very much to keep that going. We partner with the food bank here. We certainly do major walks every year to Coburg and back. We've raised money for Ukrainian refugees. We've raised money for a medical clinic in Syria. Last year, we raised money for the new youth hub going in just a block or two from here. We are very involved with Alderville First Nation, developing a partnership there, connecting through the Royal Canadian Legion, through the Port Hope Rotary Club, through many endeavors to be connected to our community. We're looking at some possibilities for the part behind the sanctuary, the annex, to look at options to put in some housing or other things that would help us continue to be relevant to the community. You know, as I do, that housing in Northumberland is a huge, huge issue, particularly affordable housing. And so we want to, in our own way, try to be part of that solution. And we won't fix the problem, but we'll be one of the pieces in the puzzle towards having adequate housing for people that need it. We certainly help when we can. If people are sleeping rough, if they're out, we try and provide some temporary shelter and try and work with other agencies to help them find something more permanent. We've had some successes there and some failures over the years, but we continue to strive to do that support a number of causes in our area. I think last year or the year before, our yearly budget was about $225,000, and out of that budget, about $75,000 was put back into the community or into around the world, basically, through the United Church Mission and Service Fund. So we want to make sure that we share our resources with those that need it the most. Just to tell you that May 31st and June 1st are our anniversary weekend. We have former ministers, Reverends Peter and Joan Wyatt, coming to be with us. They were here in the early 80s. May 31st at 6 p.m., we are having an anniversary banquet at the Port Hope Lions Recreation Center. Tickets are $60, and if they phone the church, 905-885-2421, they can order tickets. And then on the Sunday morning at 10:25, we will have our 100 and 150th anniversary celebration here at the church, and we'd love for folks to drop in and join us, and there will be some cake afterwards, so a little sweetener there, and looking forward to a wonderful weekend to celebrate all that went before and to really look ahead to what exciting things are before us.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, May 22nd, another rainy day here in the city of Kingston. Cloudy with a 60% chance of precipitation, daytime high of 13 degrees, overnight low of 8. Friday, May 23rd, another rainy day. Third in a row here in the city of Kingston, cloudy with a 60% chance of showers and a daytime high of 13 degrees, dropping down to 8 overnight. Saturday, May 24th, 14 degrees with a 40% chance of showers. Moving into the end of the weekend, Sunday, May 25th, it is going to be the first bit of sun we see in the city. High of 17 degrees, overnight low of 8, and Monday, May 26th, daytime high of 17 with an overnight low of 8. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. We begin with road closures. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Aberdeen Street, William to Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed until May 30th. For construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Cassidy Street, Montreal to Maple is closed until June 6th as part of the ongoing intersection improvements of Montreal and John Counter. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria is closed until the end of August for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. And Victoria Street, Princess to North Bartlett is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson. Expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess. Expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Expect significant delays on Gardner's Road between the Invista Center and the 401, and on Creekford and Centennial near the Gardens intersection from May 23rd until May 24th at 7 p.m. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users. Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.